this week's episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast. I'm your host, Pearl Love, editor of the Cincinnati Enquirer. With me today, it's been a while since we've had you here, is our business reporter extraordinaire, Alex Coolidge. How are you, Alex?
I'm fine.
So, Alex, you're probably wondering why you are here.
I am wondering.
Okay,
why
well,
why
our
am I here?
Special guest today is Amy Spiller, the Ohio and Kentucky president of Duke Energy.
Oh, exciting.
So we're going to talk to her. This is a timely conversation because everybody's going to open up that winter heating bill.
I made the mistake of opening it up early.
Oh, yes. So we'll talk about that. But we'll talk about all kinds of things. She's very involved civically in town on many boards, just a wonderful leader. It'll be great to talk to her. But before we bring in Amy, Alex, last week you wrote about the situation at Kroger where the search for a new CEO has just been dragging and dragging and
11 months and counting.
And as if they were waiting for your story
right
to drop.
Yes.
What, less than 2 days later?
Maybe four or five.
Maybe max. Four or five. We have a new CEO. So what can you tell us about the new CEO of Kroger?
Well, first, he was on the short list that was in our story last week.
So amazing insight from,
indeed.
From Enquirer reporting.
Yes. Intrepid reporting. Amazing reporting. It wasn't that difficult to sort of he was a kind of a starting point, a person. Basically, Kroger's made it very clear that they wanted somebody who could operate a large retail operation. So, you know.
Well, you're bearing the lead. Who is it?
Well, you know, the guys, the pick is Greg Foran. He is the former head of Walmart's U.S. stores operation, where he ran about 4,000 Walmarts nationwide for about 5 years.
We have reported a lot about how Kroger deals with Walmart as a competitor. And I guess it's if you want to put on a good fight, you steal from the competition. Is that what this is? Is this a case of if you can't beat them, grab their people?
Well, they basically wanted somebody who could operate a bunch of stores, not just some internet guy or somebody who was. Running some unrelated operations. So yeah, it's a logical choice. The pool of potential candidates for running a huge retailer like Kroger is a pretty small one.
Well, what do we know about this guy? He's not exactly a young whippersnapper. He's what, 64?
He's
been around a while.
64. He started actually at a supermarket chain giant in Australia and New Zealand. It's called Woolworths, but it's not to be confused with F.W. Woolworths of American fame. And apparently, became a store man. He started when he was 17 and became a store manager when he was only 20 and just kept rising through the ranks there. Then he jumped ship in 2011 and started working for Walmart overseas and quickly became the CEO of Walmart in China and then all of Asia before he took over as the CEO of U.S. stores in Walmart. And basically the guy's known for being just a stores, just a very hands-on store management type. He's all about decluttering and making sure.
I was going to ask you what his first initial mark might be on Kroger, and it seems like, according to your story, that he's all about making sure that the existing infrastructure is good, like cleaning up stores, sprucing them up.
Yes.
sweating customer experience and all of that.
Yeah. Kroger is not perceived as some, you know, basket case turnaround that desperately needs a massive overhaul fixing, but it's been sort of course correcting a little bit in the last year or so, in the wake of, you know, as we continue to move beyond the pandemic. The biggest rap on Kroger in recent years is that they have spent a ton of money building a digital business from scratch that has not been profitable. It does $12 billion in business. It's a huge chunk of their sales. And just in the last several months, the interim CEO, who has stepped aside, overhauled some of the operations. He shut down three of those robotic warehouses, which were going to be dedicated just to home delivery. And they're signaling that they're going to move more of that. But the other wrap on that, though, is they've been spending so much time focusing on building digital. There have been some gripes that they've maybe taken their eye off of the ball with the physical stores.
The brick and mortar.
The brick and mortar.
Where still most of their customers engage with them.
Yes. I mean, what Kroger has rediscovered is that most customers want to do a little of both. They don't. One of the digital warehouses they shut down was in Florida, where Kroger had a very minimal presence, and they were like going, "We don't have time to build a mostly digital business here. We do best where we have stores and digital options." So that's where they're sort of correcting towards.
So Greg Foran is from New Zealand, and it looks like he is leaving. He's not leaving Walmart directly to come to Kroger. He spent a little time running an airline.
Yeah, because
so basically, this guy
not?
Can just run stuff. That's his forte, right?
It would seem.
Doesn't matter.
Yes.
Grocery chain, airline, who knows?
He was widely seen as a potential CEO of Walmart when he was running the U.S. stores, and that's typically where Walmart picks their CEOs. They either get the head of Sam's Club, the head of international, or the head of U.S. And but you know, in 2019, when he was getting a little tired, I guess, of being the U.S. CEO, the then current CEO, you know, showed no signs of moving on. So he got a job offer back home and decided to run an airline.
So very quickly, before we bring in our special guest, Amy Spiller from Duke Energy, Foran is replacing interim CEO
Ron Sargent.
Paul, yes. And he's been interim CEO for almost a year. He stepped
months.
In
yeah.
when Kroger's former CEO, Rodney McMullen, was involved in a little bit of an ethics situation.
Which they still haven't really disclosed. I assume it's all locked up in non-disclosures.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like I said, before
we
go into special guest time, there hasn't been much light shed on what exactly the situation was.
The company has disclosed in SEC documents that it was nothing to do with operations, nothing to do with a Kroger associate, nothing to do with financials. But beyond that, they've just said some sort of violation or something not in keeping with their ethics policy. And they also said that they discovered something, and within about 2 weeks, he was gone. So it was not something that they'd been investigating for 6 months.
Very intriguing. And still no disclosure of what that was.
We almost found out. We almost found out from Jewel, because Jewel, in her lawsuit with Kroger, actually tried to pry that open.
You're talking about the 90s singer Jewel, not the grocery store brand.
You were meant for me, yes.
And Alex, I was meant for you.
Yes.
That's right. We did find out about that because what, she filed a lawsuit against Kroger or the other way around?
In the early founding of the Kroger Wellness Festival, she was heavily involved. And
yeah, she headlined the Wellness Festival here.
And her company sort of owned it, only apparently it was all done on handshakes and there was no contract. And then at some point, Kroger says, this is going pretty well. You know what? We don't need you anymore, Jewel. You were not meant for us. And so she's saying,
that song is stuck in my head all day, Alex.
I am to blame.
You are to blame. Yes. All right. Well, again, intriguing. I'm sure that if anyone's going to break that story, it will be you. But on that note, let's bring in our special guest.
Okay.
Special guest time on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. And as promised, we have with us today the president of Duke Energy for Ohio and Kentucky, Amy Spiller. Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Burl. I'm happy to be with you this morning.
So we didn't do this intentionally, but we have you in our studio during one of the coldest stretches of the year while everyone is thinking about energy, heat, electricity, paying that utility bill. So it's like we're brilliant, like we timed it this way, but this was kind of random. But so let's just start there. Is this, leading Duke Energy here, is this your Super Bowl season? Is this when you have to shine?
I think 24/7 our team shines, Burl, but when we have extreme weather, extreme cold, extreme heat, extreme storm season, that's really when our team is at their best. And we saw that with Winter Storm Fern. We sent some of our line crew down to the Carolinas, but kept back those here, making sure that we could continue to keep the lights on. And we weathered Winter Storm Fern, I think, very well here, notwithstanding the cold weather. But then we had some other incidents with some outages due to motor vehicle accidents. And our crews are amazing when I think about these incredibly cold sub-zero temperatures, and they're out there working to get the lights back on as quickly as they can.
When people get their Duke bills this month, there might be some sticker shock. What are... when people call in for help, when people call in, is that one of the things that is more challenging to manage from a customer service standpoint this time of year when bills are high?
You know, we very much want our customers to call us. I think sometimes there is trepidation with reaching out to the entity that might be sending you the bill. But we have an incredible customer care organization that is committed to connecting our customers to resources, whether that is the Share the Light Fund that we manage through the generosity of employees and shareholders. It could be a state income, low income program that might be available. But we have an agency portal where our nonprofit agencies can more readily communicate with us and connect with us and in turn deploy that assistance back out into the community.
What are some of those partners, those nonprofits that you work with?
Salvation Army is a big one. The United Way over in Northern Kentucky, the Northern Kentucky Community Action Commission. Here are community action agencies. So a lot of engagement with those entities to ensure that we are providing our customers with the resources that they need.
And if I recall, not to put you on the spot with bringing statistics out of your mind, customers have the option too of adding a little bit when they pay the bill. I've always wondered how many people actually do that.
We actually have customers who do contribute to Share the Light. So you can, on your monthly bill, add a little bit more if you are a customer. And we appreciate the generosity of our employees and our customers as we look out for our neighbors.
So let's back up a little bit, as we like to do on the podcast, help our listeners get to know people a little better. You are a lawyer by trade and by most of your professional life.
I am.
And that's how you got into the Duke family.
That's correct.
For Synergy, right?
It was Synergy at the time, yes.
Yeah. Did you think that you were on the path to being the top executive for our region?
Absolutely not. And when I joined the company, I probably didn't know that there was a regional president of the local organization. I joined Synergy because I was impressed with the work that they did.
As corporate counsel,
yes. And it is a very complex industry that we have, Burl, but my colleagues on the operations side were amazing. And you could see the commitment from day one, the commitment they had to our community, the commitment to each other. And it had that has motivated me, I think, every day coming to work, getting to work with such impassioned colleagues. But yes, was in the legal department for a lot of my career with Duke Energy. And then it's a company where you have opportunities to grow and develop and serve this community in different ways.
One of the things that has occurred during your time in this industry is choice that customers have. We all get in the mail these solicitations to switch providers. And I've always been confused by that because I'm easily confused because I'm thinking, well, it's not like they're going to come and run new lines or, you know, unplug my house from Duke and plug me in. So the network doesn't change. And so for the novice, how has that changed your industry? And what is your take on, is that here to stay? Is that going to be, is it going to expand? Where are we with that choice that people have right now?
So probably in the early 2000s, Ohio lawmakers made the decision to deregulate, meaning the electric utilities did not participate in generation. When you think of stepping back for a moment, when you think about electric supply, we need to generate the power and then transmit that power through the high speed transmission lines. So we are carrying a lot of power at very high voltages to move it quickly. And then you lower the voltage and then distribute that power supply into homes and businesses. So if you sort of compartmentalize with the production, the transmission, and the distribution, we are no longer in the production business here in Ohio. And so any customer can stay with us, Duke Energy, for purposes of the supply. Mm-hmm. Or they can choose a competitive supplier. We will respond to the outages. We are sending you the bill. We are there in the community to support you. I agree it's confusing for customers, and in large part because of the number of suppliers we have in this community. It could be 80 or 100 different suppliers making competitive solicitations to our customers. I do think it's here. Last year, lawmakers passed a bill that affirmed the inability of electric utilities to own generation in the state. So we do spend a lot of time really trying to educate our customers so that they can make informed decisions on where they want to, who they want to partner with for the generation supply.
So you're, in a sense, buying the power to transmit, and me as a consumer, I can say, I'm going to decide who I want to purchase that from myself, but you are still on the hook for delivering it, servicing. Does that put stress on energy providers as far as managing costs and being able to control profitability and all the things that normal company, it's kind of unique that most businesses manage their supply, and don't have that dynamic going on. So how's that changed, like your role as a senior leader in the company?
Sure. For us, again, whatever cost we incur to procure, to buy that power, that's what we pass on dollar for dollar to our customers. Whether or not competitive suppliers do the same, I don't know. I don't have visibility into their rates and their pricing structures. But because we are the company that really is there in the community interacting with our customers every single day, they see the bill from us. The challenge, Burl, comes when they see that bill and there are changes in the generation cost. Mm-hmm. that we don't know about because we don't set. It's set by their competitive supplier, but the questions come to us.
Right.
So that, I think, is the challenge. And just continuing with our very diverse customer population to explain customer choice to them.
And it's different in Kentucky, right?
In Kentucky, we are what's known as vertically integrated, meaning we're responsible for all of it. Mm-hmm. We own generation, so we're generating power.
When you say own generation, you own the power plant.
We own the power plants, okay. Yes.
And so I should know this, but there's no choice program in Kentucky, correct?
Correct.
Okay. If you were just, you know, at a summer barbecue and someone asked you that because they got the mail, what would your advice be to somebody, a consumer who is weighing, you know, choosing their, you know, switching from your generation, right, to some other companies?
I think what I would want customers to remember is the way we're structured in Ohio and where Duke Energy Ohio and competitive suppliers are buying power. Burl, we're going to the same market. We're going to the same apple orchard, right? Mm-hmm. And what I sell you my apples for is the price that I buy them for. Other suppliers may not be doing that. So I think it's important to be aware. And if you're going to shop, you really need to pay attention over time as to what you're paying. And I think for our large customers with energy managers, they're looking at those bills on a regular basis and really understanding the choices. I think for a residential customer, some of it can be a little overwhelming. I think the other nuance here is we have community aggregation, meaning that a community such as the city of Cincinnati can decide to pool together the residential customers within their border, as well as small commercial customers, and take that out for bid to try to get a contract with a supplier to serve those customers, again, within their borders. And some customers don't recognize when they've become part of an aggregation.
It's changing that rapidly.
It is changing that rapidly. And they don't appreciate that they are now with a different supplier.
Okay. Well, before we leave the realm of energy and Duke, Alex.
Hello.
How are you? Did you have any follow-up questions for Amy?
Well, listen, just to clarify, I write about these issues every several few months, and it feels like I have to relearn them all. But basically, the way the system works here in Ohio is you don't generate the gas or the electricity in Ohio, but you own the grid and you own the pipes. That's how it works, basically. And then you service them.
Correct.
You are a conduit. And you're barred from generating those, basically, in the state of Ohio, correct?
Correct.
But you're vertically integrated in Kentucky, which is a better system. What's more efficient? People are worried about their energy bills these days. The hottest thing this winter is my energy bill heating my house.
In other words, which state is doing it better?
Yeah. I mean, you're in the industry, you have expertise. If it were up to you, which is a better system?
I can tell you, Alex, within the Duke Energy family, so we operate electric utilities in 6 states. Ohio is the only one that is deregulated, where we don't own the generation. And we have significant expertise mm-hmm. in long-term investments. And generating plants are just that. They are a long-term investment. And so we are able in our other jurisdictions to thoughtfully plan out the service obligations that we will have for our customers over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And that is a structure that I think works very well. So we can work very closely with our customers, with load forecasting, with economic development partners to get a sense as to the growth profile. And then we can plan for our customers in a way that really helps ensure some rate stability.
Your wheelhouse is vertical integration. And if you had your way that's how it would work, or is that a fair characterization?
I think the benefit of a vertically integrated utility, Alex, is we're not dependent on others to be building generation to serve our customers. Mm-hmm. And with your awareness of the market that we have here, the regional transmission organization that's responsible for moving power mm-hmm. across 13 states, including Ohio, and the District of Columbia, right? They have some constraints with resource adequacy with that generation supply. When you're vertically integrated, you have better control of your destiny. And that is important when you're in a service obligation.
Is deregulation a failure?
I don't think the regulation is a failure. I mean, our lawmakers decided 25 years ago to deregulate. They renewed that commitment last year with some state legislation, and they did so intending the law that they passed to encourage more generation to be built here in Ohio.
Has that worked?
There's generation in the queue to be built, but there are complications with PJM and advancing that generation through the PJM process.
And PJM is?
PJM, Burl, is a regional transmission organization. They are, again, responsible for managing the movement of power across 13 states and the District of Columbia.
Who put them in charge? PJM. They don't own any utilities. They're like an air traffic controller for the region's energies needs, basically.
We are, when we deregulated, mm-hmm. I think by default, you are ceding some control mm-hmm. to that market. By law, we are required to belong to a regional transmission organization here in Ohio. So as a member of that organization, I think you do give up a little flexibility.
What's driving the inflation in electricity across the country? And by the way, it is a national issue. If you're at home listening to this and you're wearing a thick sweater and turning the thermostat down, it's not just you. It's actually, I was looking at the inflation numbers because I do that stuff. 12-month inflation nationwide's up 2.7%, but energy services is up 6.7%. Utility piped gas is up 10.8%. Electricity is up 6.7%. These are the biggest rises in the entire CPI. What's driving electricity to go up, and what's causing natural gas prices to go up? It's not just here, it's everywhere.
It is everywhere, and some of that will be influenced by where you are. In California, power prices are impacted in large part by wildfire and wildfire mitigation. And so they are now burying those transmission lines in California, and that is a cost that customers are seeing. In the Northeast, you're seeing higher rates because they are participating in very volatile wholesale markets to buy that power. So you're seeing the influence there. When I look here in Ohio, we have seen a dramatic increase in the cost of generation supply within PJM, a very significant increase. And when I think about the bill that we send to our Ohio customers every month, more than half of that bill is comprised of the generation cost.
And why are the generation costs going up?
Because within PJM, you have seen generation retire. New generation is not coming online at the same pace. Generation that is coming online more than not is interruptible, solar, wind. Mm. And then you are seeing this moment in the country where there is significant demand for power. With the reshoring of manufacturing, with population growth, and also with large loads, including data centers. So you see the demand increasing within states that comprise PJM. and then you see your supply declining.
Mm-hmm.
And that hasn't, that is contributing to an increase in prices.
What about natural gas, which also heats houses, obviously?
Natural gas does also heat houses. You're seeing, natural gas. Those prices have been lower of late, but I know recently they have increased somewhat. It is a commodity that is being used for power production, as well as on the natural gas side of our business.
So we're using natural gas to generate electricity to relieve electric prices, but then ironically, natural gas prices are ticking upward.
Well, natural
Quite
gas
a balancing act here.
Yeah, it is a balancing act. Natural gas generation, though, Alex, is, we call it base load generation, meaning it, once you get that plant up and running, it runs.
Mm-hmm.
It is not dependent on the wind. It is not dependent on the sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
So natural gas generation actually is a very reliable form of generation. And as you are seeing older plants retire, natural gas generation is, I think, really important to ensure that reliability and resiliency that our customers depend on to run their businesses and to light their homes.
But that, because the grid, the electric grid, is becoming more reliant on natural gas, that will over time push up the price of natural gas as well then?
It can, but we continue, as we think about our service obligations to our customers, Alex, we continue to incorporate innovation. Where can we be efficient? Where can we reduce the cost of the service to our customers? So we think every day about what can we do to keep those prices as low as possible for our customers.
Okay.
Back to the grid real quick. Boy, we're getting wonky here, but
sorry,
but that's okay.
You invited me.
I had to look up PJM because I was so curious.
Sounds like a sandwich, doesn't
it? Well, it's Pennsylvania, Jersey, and Maryland, but then that grid management system expanded to cover a bunch of other states, including Ohio. One of the things that kind of pops in and out of the headlines is the security of the grid, whether it's antiquated and we haven't been reinvesting quickly enough, or it's susceptible to terrorist attacks. I haven't heard a lot about that lately, but it is one of the things that I think sometimes, to get a little less wonky here, that people wonder about because they hear, that our grid might be more vulnerable than we would like it to be. What's the truth? What, from your perspective, is that something you worry about, the integrity of the grid?
We think about it every day, and that's why we're investing in not just the reliability, but the resiliency of the grid. So our neighbors here in the region may see us changing out a wood pole for a steel or cement pole. Those are better able to withstand inclement weather, extreme weather, and also, unfortunately, when we have a motor vehicle that contacts a pole. Right? So we are making those investments to strengthen the resiliency of our grid. We also have technology, Burl, that allows us to reroute power. If there is an incident with one portion of the grid, we can reroute that power to minimize the outages that customers may experience. So we're making investments in the integrity of the grid to really ensure that resiliency and reliability. I'd say we are also, every single day, we have a team that interacts at the local level, the state level, the federal level, with our peer utilities on best practices and what we're seeing in this space of physical security. And we are making those investments around our power plants, our substations, to ensure that physical security as well. And then, like anyone, right, our IT systems, we have firewalls upon firewalls and that redundancy to ensure that our systems are functioning appropriately. I mean, we are all prone to those scams and the phishing tactics. So we really need to ensure that our systems are strong.
When, as someone who owns your company, a significant piece of the grid, is that something that you feel you're investing in at an adequate rate, or is that something you've, you know, you're up at night thinking, how can I procure more cash to, you know, to shore up the grid? We talked about the balancing act. I mean, you know, I'm sure that drives rate and everything. Is it, how would you grade Duke as far as the integrity of the grid?
I think we are doing an incredible job with the integrity of the grid. And I think the pace of our investments, you know, it is appropriate. And you're right, we do think about the cost implications for our customers. And we do need to balance that with the service obligations that we have. But I think we're doing a really, really good job.
I mean, from your average energy customer, I've lived in other places, and it's just as reliable here, if not more, than other places I've lived. So anecdotally, I would say, yeah, I have lived in places where it's just common where power goes out. I lived out west for a while, and I don't know if it was, you know, wildfires or just mountain terrain or whatever, snowfall. You know, I lived in northern Nevada, and when it, you know, you and up there, you can get, you know, 5 feet of snow and nobody blinks an eye. But you just got used to the power going out. You just knew it. It'd be out for a while. And I think maybe we're spoiled here in the Cincinnati area, because as far as I know, we don't have those predictable, you know, and then, you know, rolling, you know, power drops and surges and things like that. What sets us up differently than some of those places that have you know, less reliability in the system?
Well, as I think about out west, some of that I'm sure is your vegetation and the terrain. When we think about what happened in California, right, you had that interaction, if you will, between vegetation and high voltage power lines. And right. I'm sure in Nevada, right, you've got heavy snowfall that can be bringing limbs down onto power lines. And in Nevada, where maybe the land is much more open and you have overhead lines traveling a great distance, it can take a little bit of time to find the cause of the outage and then come out and repair it. And that's, you know, one of the things I mentioned with Alex, how we're incorporating technology. So we are able now to use drones if there is an outage, and we will be able to more quickly find where that outage point may be, what's causing it. Is there a tree down on that line, so that we can more efficiently send out the repair crews necessary to repair that line? So we're continuing to incorporate technology to make our response times quicker and our service more efficient.
What were the peak outages during Fern here in Greater Cincinnati?
We had minimal outages, Alex, from Fern. I would say maybe a couple hundred. The more significant was probably what you saw with Green Township, mm-hmm. where we had about 5,000 customers out the following weekend because there was a significant auto accident that took out a transmission pole.
Is that because the region was lucky? We didn't get an ice storm. We just got a lot of snow, or is it because Duke's better than? We've been reading about the situation in Nashville.
Yeah.
which just sounds incredible. Massive outages lasting for more than a week, like, you know, literally the Dark Ages, I guess.
Ice is an incredible impediment and concern for a utility company. Just the weight.
What's the worst weather system to hit any power system or a power grid? Is it an ice storm, or is it, you know, what are the worst weather threats?
Ice is definitely one, because it can bring down trees onto the power lines. And then just the conditions in which our team needs to work to restore the power. But hurricanes, equally challenging. Hurricanes can have broad implication. We think about Hurricane Helene a few years ago. It was a hurricane that affected all of our jurisdictions within the Duke Energy family. And that is not common. So they can have incredible long-lasting damage.
How long was the outage in Green Township, and did you have any problems finding that, or did you automatically know what the problem was?
We knew what the problem was pretty quickly, and I want to say most of our customers were back on within, I think all of our customers were back on by 4 a.m. that Tuesday. This accident happened on Monday.
But well, most of them were back on a Monday. The technology has made our jobs easier because back in the day, if there was a snowstorm and anecdotal, you know, people would call into the newsroom to say, my power's out. We would have to start calling around different neighborhoods and kind of track our own list. Now you can just go to the Duke Energy website and you guys just put the map up. And like, I think we, you know, when Nashville started getting bad, our reporters were trying to see how bad it was here. And the breaking news editor at one of our news meetings said, oh, it looks like there are 55 people without power. So it's not really significant. Like, it didn't hit the threshold of us, you know, alerting that people have, you know, that there was widespread power. It's pretty phenomenal, the data that is available, not just to you, but just the average person, the consumer, to just go online and even find out, you know, if your power is out, what the expected time of outage is going to be, all online.
Yes, yes. And we are continuing to mature in that space in our communication with customers.
All right. Well, I want to shift gears a little bit. Because if you look at your resume, leading the region's power company is but one of your activities. You're involved in, I had to write some of them down, you know, either, you know, through board service or other aspects. You are involved with 3CDC, the Chamber, Ready, which, you know, is one of our job growth agencies, the Cincinnati Business Committee, the Futures Commission. What motivates you to be engaged civically like that?
I think Cincinnati is an incredible place to live. And I think about our opportunities with culture, with our restaurant scene, which is amazing, civic-minded leaders, I think, are peppered throughout this community. And it's a really exciting time to be here.
What brought you here?
My husband grew up in Claremont County. And so after—
This is a typical Cincinnati origin story.
It is,
Ohio,
right?
Actually. I met a nice girl in Ohio, from Ohio and Florida for myself, so.
That's right. So, where did you grow up?
I grew up in northern Michigan, and try as I may, 35 years ago, the golf season in northern Michigan was a little too short for my husband.
Okay.
So we landed here
back— Oh, it's so much better here.
We landed back home, his home in Cincinnati.
All right. And you as far as your career in energy, that started when you joined Synergy?
For energy, yes. Okay. I had represented public utilities when I was in private practice, but energy, yes.
All right. So you've been here how long?
I've been in Cincinnati since 1993.
Okay. Well, I think that counts, even though you didn't go to high school here. We'll call it.
It's home. So it's home.
It's home for you. And before I interrupted you, you were talking about, you know, the quality of life here as part of the reason you think it's important to be in, you know, to use your leadership, you know, in other ways besides, you know, who writes your paycheck. You've chosen some very, I would say, areas that drive the economy. What drew you to that?
Energy helps to drive the economy. I think without Duke Energy, nothing is possible here in the region. But I think importantly, as I think about our service obligations, we too want to see a very vibrant greater Cincinnati region. I think about the work that 3CDC does in supporting primarily the Cincinnati area, connects with the work that the port is doing for home ownership and the industrial sector. The Chamber really is an umbrella organization to help move us forward. And I think of the leaders of these organizations, Brendan Cull, Kim Lauterbach, Laura Brunner, Steve Leeper, so committed to the region, right? And there's a sense of energy, no pun intended, when I am in a conversation with them and this vision, I think a shared vision that we all have. And it's really exciting to be a part of that, to help realize the future of this region.
Talk a little bit about your involvement with 3CDC. You mentioned Steve Leeper. He's been a guest multiple times on our podcast, not as much as Brendan Call, the president of the chamber who you referenced, but Steve's getting up there. I was out of the market 12 years. I'm from here. And even though I would come back to visit, it was eye-opening to me the changes within the center city driven by 3CDC. And when I left Cincinnati, Steve had just come on, and I think there was a lot of trepidation. You know, why are we letting this private nonprofit handle things that perhaps, you know, the governments should be handling? Well, we know the answer to that. Governments are bad at doing development. But, you know, back then, it was... It wasn't something everybody was on board with. And coming back, you see the results, you see how the operation has grown. What, in terms of 3CDC and the investment in the center of the city, how would you grade the efforts since you've been here? And where do you think what when you look at the horizon, what do you think is next?
I think 3CDC has done incredible work. So A plus, if I can give them an A plus. And Burrell, living in OTR, I see their handiwork every single day. I see the good work that their ambassadors do in keeping the streets clean and just their engagement. When I look at Washington Park, it is a gathering place. And just the diversity that is visible in Washington Park. It's amazing. And then what 3CDC has done to support small businesses, particularly our restaurateurs and those small business owners in OTR, they have enabled a sense of community that you don't necessarily feel in other places. So I think their work, their commitment, they care deeply about the city, and that reflects in the compassion of their employees and their leadership and what they're doing. They're now taking, you know, they take on challenges that maybe no one else is ready to take on. And they take them on with enthusiasm,
like parking,
yes.
Picking up litter.
Yes.
You know, it's funny. I just have this vision of Steve, you know, wanting to focus obviously on what he was hired to do, but also thinking, you know, these are things that are getting in my way, so I'm just going to do it myself. You know, everybody, we need more parking, or it needs to be managing better. 3CDC can do that. We need more, you know, we need more events program, you know, at the square and music and activities. Well, we'll take that on too. As someone on the board, do you think they're going too wide? Do you think that's appropriate?
I think what they're doing is appropriate. You know, they thought about the convention center, right? And their engagement and involvement with the convention center. And look at what we have. The plaza is incredible. You know, they're north of Liberty now, the work that they're doing there. I think they are very measured and deliberate, but you're right. 3CDC reminds me of that adage, if you want something done, give it to a busy person.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So as an OTR resident, we're going to get into the fun stuff now. Do you have any favorite restaurants? You brought up the dining scene here.
Colette, Wild Weed. Those are two of our favorites in OTR. I've not yet made it to the new Salazar. I do appreciate Safi, the mm-hmm. former Salazar place. Mm-hmm. So those are some of our go-tos.
When safety was an issue this summer, did you have any personal concerns being a OTR resident?
I did not have any personal concerns. And I am one, Burrell, who loves to walk. So I am out every day, walking to and from work, walking to and from the market, the yoga studio, whatever the case may be. I did not at all feel a concern.
Do you think that the business community coming together was effective in helping prioritize?
I think at the business community adding their voice was very important to addressing the perception that we have with public safety in the city, because perception is reality. And I want to make sure our employees feel safe coming to and from the workplace. And Burl, we dispatch our employees to every part of this city 24/7. So I needed the assurance that we could send them out with their safety being well cared for. And so I do think the focus on public safety is incredibly important.
Where would you, as far as, you know, like I said, you're involved in a lot of these groups that, you know, have, you know, their mission is, you know, growth and, you know, bringing jobs in the case of Ready, development in the case of 3CDC. Many people say that, you know, outsiders look at Cincinnati and say, wow, what a renaissance they've experienced. But us insiders, if you lived here, like, we're our own worst critics. Like, it's never good enough. So, you know, let's consider it a given that, you know, we've come a long way. From your perspective and with all these groups you're involved in, what do you think are some of the, if you were to list a couple of the challenges and prioritize them, what would that list look like?
I think we are all, there are so many civically minded individuals in this community that give of their time, their talent, their treasure. I think, and we have different organizations involved in growth. And I think just one of the opportunities that we have is how do we better connect the work and identify those swim lanes for each of the organizations and not duplicate work, but make sure we're not creating any gaps so that we can more efficiently and effectively advance our shared priorities. And I think some of it, that probably, Burl, is another opportunity, is how do we identify what those shared priorities are and then rank them? You know, we've had a lot of conversation around, do we cap Fort Washington Way? We're thinking about a new arena. We're thinking about sort of how we can transform a portion of Central Parkway so that it's more pedestrian friendly. Those are all things, I think, big infrastructure ideas that are talked about. But how do we really think about the community we are serving today and what is best for the community we serve today? And then how do we create that future that is just welcoming and creates opportunity for all?
When you mentioned swim lanes, do you think sometimes some of these organizations and leaders get in each other's way or trip over each other, or at least, you know, aren't bringing together their superpowers in one, you know, there's a lot of things going on, but do you think sometimes we get in our own way?
I do think when we bring our superpowers together, it's incredible. So think about what we did trying to solicit the FIFA World Cup. Mm-hmm. I think that is happening this year. Kristen Schlottmann and what she curated with respect to Sundance and the bid that we put there. When we work together, it's amazing. I think sometimes maybe we're too polite and don't rally together the troops as we need to.
All right. Now, I've saved the most hard-hitting, perhaps controversial question for last.
Okay.
All right. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. You are the... Do you know what I'm going to ask, Alex?
No.
Okay. So here you are.
I'm nervous myself.
Yes. Be nervous.
That makes me nervous.
Yeah. You should be very nervous, okay?
Tension City here.
You are the president of Duke Energy in Ohio and Kentucky. I think the world needs to know, where is your thermostat set in your home?
Oh, that's a good one.
That is a really,
I want to know.
That is a really good one. I will say my...
You need to be honest.
All right, I'll be honest.
All right.
My husband's a little more warm-blooded. So we're at about 67.
67. So that's the compromise position?
That is the compromise. Yeah.
If he's gone for the weekend, where do you put the thermostat?
I just leave it at 67.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's an aspiration for some people, and others are going to say, wow, that's pretty high. But yeah, we're at 65.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's a two-story, so like the upper, you know, where we sleep is always warmer because of just hot, you know, heat rising and everything
right.
like that. But it is a little chilly on the first floor.
But it is nice to sleep in a colder room.
Yeah. So
you turn
like,
it down at night.
And even though I have a programmable thermostat, I'm too lazy to figure that out, so I just lock it into 65.
Another device to program.
I know. Oh. All right. Well, now we know where Amy Spiller sets her thermostat, 67 degrees. Amy, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
All right. Well, that was a deep dive into what it's like to lead our region's power company. And also, I think, a good tip in terms of, you know, a reasonable place to set your thermostat.
Indeed.
Wouldn't you say?
I'm a mover. I move my thermostat. It's up in the day and then down at night.
I hear that's harder on your furnace, though. Like, it's better to maintain a consistent temperature than to be changing it all the time.
I've never heard that.
Because it works a lot less to maintain a temperature than to, like, just going up 3 degrees. It really, like, puts, you know, that's where you're spending energy.
Wow, that's crazy.
Pro tip from me.
Well, thank
the
you.
More you know, the little rainbow and the star thing.
Indeed.
All okay. right. So, Alex, we always like to talk about, at the end of the podcast, as you know, something that we have witnessed done that is just so Cincinnati. And I'm sure, because I know who you're married to.
Oh, yes.
Sherry Coolidge, gal about town.
Yes.
Former Enquirer City Hall reporter who likes to keep her finger on the pulse of all things happening in Cincinnati. You certainly have done probably something noteworthy that you could share today.
I did. Sherry pulled me away from my stack of Kroger reports that I are still on the dining room table, and as you know, I married a nice Youngstown girl, and she was so excited about a visiting a new restaurant that just got the James Beard nomination. That's founded by a Youngstown native, basically. So we went to Sedova, and it was really wonderful.
Well, she told me, because, you know, I saw you and Sherry last night, that she was excited to go to Sedova, not just because the chef owner, Sarah Dworak, became a finalist for a James Beard Award, but via our podcast that she had something very much in common with Sarah, and that's, you know, coming from Youngstown. And some of the restaurants that Sarah had enjoyed in Youngstown because of the influence of Eastern Europeans in that part of Ohio were very familiar to Sherry. So we need to know, did you enjoy your dinner at Sedova?
I did. I was very... I got the stroganoff. It was wonderful.
You know, I can't think of too many restaurants you could go to today and order stroganoff. I mean, that's a classic, like 60s. You know, if you look at cookbooks from the 60s and early 70s, they all had a stroganoff recipe. And recipes that involved like mayonnaise and jello in combinations that should never be replicated today. Wouldn't you say?
Leave it to the professionals. It was really good. I thought it was a safe bet.
So did you eat at the bar or the table?
We ate at the bar.
We did too when we went. That's like a great experience. It's got a nice long bar. It's one of those, what, like a shotgun hall, you know?
It was a deep restaurant. It was a really good vibe. The atmosphere was really nice. I liked it.
So we're also talking about how some of these restaurants, because of their James Beard nominations or because they're the buzz right now, are hard to get into to get reservations. But the pro tip, as Sherry and I discussed last night, was, you know, if you're trying to get into the new Salazar, for example, on the weekend, good luck. You know, you're going to be a few weeks out. But Tuesdays, Wednesdays, that's the time to go.
Well,
Pro tip.
She knows what she's doing.
She does. All right. Well, Alex, should we wrap up this podcast?
No. Okay, sure.
All right. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the That's So Cincinnati podcast, a production of the Enquirer and Cincinnati.com. Our producer today, the wonderful Sam Green.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe, give us a rating, and share it with a friend who loves all things Cincinnati.
Do you love all things Cincinnati, Alex?
Absolutely.
Finally, if you value local journalism, and I know you do, and haven't subscribed for full digital access to Cincinnati.com, now is a great time. Just go to Cincinnati.com and click on the subscribe button to see a special offer for new subscribers.
Thanks again. See you next week.